First, we have a classic program in the making. We have live from, I think, Northern California, Matthew Lazar. And Matthew Lazar is the official, unofficial Pacifica historian. He is the author of the book Pacifica, The Rise of an Alternative...
Radio, the Rise of an Alternative Network.
Pacifica Radio...
I should also tell you that there are two other official, unofficial historians.
Two others, okay.
Yeah. There's Jeff Land, and he wrote a very good book called Active Radio, Pacifica's Brash Experiment, which all Pacifica history buffs should read. And then there's a new book by a very talented writer, Jesse Walker, called Rebels in the Air, which isn't precisely about Pacifica, but it has a lot of stuff about Pacifica in it, and it's a very good book about the history of radio in the United States in general. Rebels in the Air. Jeff Land's book is Minnesota Press, and Jesse Walker's book is NYU Press. That's right. Anyway, read them all. Buy all three. Makes a great holiday gift, although it's a little in advance. But I just thought I'd throw that out because I don't want to hog the spotlight.
Okay, so there are three official, unofficial...
And then there's Ralph Engelman's book, Public Broadcasting, A Political History, which also has a lot about Pacifica in it, in case you want to get obsessive here.
Okay. I have three of those, but to hear them all listed sounds like a whole literature.
Well, it is a whole literature, and I hope it gets even bigger.
You do. You think anybody's interested, that many people are interested?
Well, I don't think that many people are interested, but it's a worthwhile subject. I think that there is a lot more to say about Pacifica history, and there's a lot more to say about non-commercial radio history in general. I wish that the array of historians was a little bit more diverse. There's a really good book to be written about community radio and race and gender, which nobody has really written, and I encourage somebody to get out there and write. But I don't want to get into a big bibliographical essay with you here, Roy. I want to say that it's really nice to talk to you. And hello to everybody out there in the Los Angeles night who's listening to me and you talk about this. You were the first person to interview me about my book. Do you know that?
Well, I didn't know it until you told me the other day when we were arranging this interview.
Yes, you were the very first person.
I am honored. I think it's a great book.
Well, thank you very much, Roy. I appreciate that. I also appreciate the fact that you were the first person who called me up and said, I really want to talk to you on the air. A lot of water has passed under the bridge since then. Most of it very, very stormy, churny water.
Yes, and I should say I'm very happy to be able to talk to you without sweating that maybe we will cross some kind of infernal boundary and endanger my position.
And you will be convicted of breaking the gag rule and sent to purgatory.
Well, I'm not sure if being kicked out of KPFK and being in purgatory are the same thing.
But that's a very good point.
Knowing so many people who have been ousted. Anyway, so how could one characterize you? Would you be objective or which side are you on, if there is a side? How would one characterize your stance? Because what we're going to do... what you wanted to do and what I think should be done is look at the broad sweep of the last seven amazing years.
Yes. I actually have come to call the conflict that we've been passing through, I call it the seven-year war, Pacifica seven-year war. I want to talk to you tonight about all of that, and mostly what I do when I talk to people about this, since over the last 3 years, I've really just been sort of thinking out loud constantly, sometimes with great success, sometimes with not very much success, but that's the way I've been doing it. But most of the time, I don't talk about myself very much. And tonight, since it's midnight and feel safe, I'm going to talk about myself a little bit and about my own history and positionality, as the postmodernists like to say, within this whole big struggle that has taken place. When you interviewed me 3 years ago, was it 3 years ago? I guess almost, almost exactly 3 years ago on your show, my book had just come out, and I think it's safe to say, this is true confessions time, that I was more or less a Pacifica supporter. I mean, I'm a Pacifica supporter now, but that's a very different, it's a very different Pacifica. But back then I was a Pacifica supporter of the Pat Scott Pacifica. I mean, if you talked to me then, I think you would have heard many of the traditional defenses of Pacifica policy from me at the time, including the gag rule. I was someone who was close to the leadership of the organization. I had spent much of the previous 2 years working in the Pacifica National Office back when it was in Berkeley, reorganizing their files. I was friends with Pat Scott. I'm still friends with Pat Scott, actually. I don't agree with her about a lot of things, but just saw her at a memorial service and had very friendly words with her. But I was becoming increasingly alarmed at the direction that the organization was going, and I wasn't publicly speaking out about it. In fact, I was having lots of fights with people on the Internet. I actually belonged to one of the earliest Internet lists, and I was the guy who everybody was always pissed off about on the list because I was always defending Pacifica at the time. And I bet you that there are even some people listening to this who remember that. This was like 1994, 1995. It's a long time ago. But privately, I was starting to get very nervous about what was going on. And I was particularly nervous about the centralization, the possible centralization of the national board, of not allowing local advisory boards to appoint members to the national board or sit on the national board themselves as members of local advisory boards. I began privately meeting with people. I met with Lynn Chadwick. I met with Pat. I talked with other people in the development department. And I very explicitly told them that if you centralize the national board and you make it a self-appointing body, everything in the organization will very quickly collapse as a national organization. The parts of the body will continue to function to varying degrees of success, but everything as a national organization will very quickly collapse, and the organization will become radicalized. And I explained to them that you cannot have an organization in which every day you listen to the radio, what you hear on Pacifica Radio is that the world should be run more democratically. From Indonesia to Chile, from the LAPD to the NYPD, from the heights of the World Trade Organization to the lowliest ballot box in Florida, the Pacifica prescription to reality is that there is no way to democracy. Democracy is the way. I mean, you've got a daily show called Democracy Now. In fact, Pacifica's fundraising literature referred to it as democratic communications. I said, you can't have a self-appointing board in a culture like this. It's not possible. And I warned them that what would happen is that the organization would become increasingly radicalized, increasingly power would go from the national board to the margins. And I think it's safe to say, if I may congratulate myself now for something I wish that had never happened, but I think it's safe to say that I was right.
You were right.
There was one thing, however, that I could not predict. At the time, I was speaking to these people as an institutional conservative, as someone who was interested in order and stability within the organization. And I was speaking to them privately. There was one thing that I couldn't predict, and that is that not only would the organization become radicalized, but I would as well. As all of these terrible things began happening, as the lockdown of KPFA, the situation that developed with the Pacifica Network News, as all of these things,
you'll have to recognize that to our listenership, most of them, the terms lockdown at KPFA and Pacifica Network
is all
unknown. We've been censored for a long time.
In in April of 1999, Pacifica National Office decided 2 weeks before the 50th anniversary of KPFA to terminate the employment of KPFA's general manager.
Popular general manager.
Very popular
Successful.
General manager. Successful. Yeah, Nicole Sawaya. Everyone liked Nicole at KPFA, including me. Pat Scott had hired her. She was someone who brought a sense of peace and collegiality to KPFA, which had not existed for a very, very long time. And it was such a relief to have her around. I mean, she did things like she was the first general manager that KPFA had had in years who actually knew radio enough that she would actually, when on election nights, she would help out with the news. And you'd hear her on election night. And this was just a remarkable thing to people, that she was just so familiar with everything that she could do that, because the previous general managers hadn't really been like that. When she was dismissed 2 weeks before KPFA's 50th anniversary, it was taken with enormous alarm. And everything that happened at KPFA was responded to with gasoline thrown on the flames. The KPFA news department ran a story about Sawaya's dismissal, and Lynn Chadwick, who was at that time executive director, told them not to run it. Larry Bensky started talking about it, and he was fired. He was actually fired for the second time. He'd been fired before and rehired, and he was fired again. And there just didn't seem to be any match anywhere that Pacifica didn't want to throw more gasoline on. So the result was is that things went from worse to worse to worse. Finally, Pacifica hired armed guards, stuck them in KPFA. The ostensible reason for this was is that shortly after Sawaya's dismissal, somebody fired shots into the Pacifica National Office. But I found it, which was at the time next door to KPFA. But I found it very peculiar that these guards were not placed in front of the Pacifica National Office. Instead, they were placed in KPFA's headquarters. Gradually, it's clear now that Pacifica was planning and eventually did shut the station down. They shut the station down on July 13th of 1999, shortly after it was discovered that a member of the Pacifica National Board had sent a memo to Mary Frances Berry suggesting the selling of KPFA or WBAI and or both. Following this, I had sort of hoped...
Oh, we're talking about, at the time, of $150 to $200 million. That's
yes.
The sum.
WBAI was at that time estimated to be about $200 million in worth, and KPFA at the time was estimated at $60 million. I've actually spoken to lawyers subsequently who think that KPFA is worth about $110 million. But in any event, fortunately now we have a national board which is moving in a different direction than selling either of these stations, and I'm very relieved about that. In any event, these kind of things, and they continued to go on. People who broke the gag rule got dismissed. Dan Coughlin, who was at that time the executive director of the Pacifica Network News, allowed a short 37-second reader about affiliate dissatisfaction with the network, and shortly after that, he was dismissed. WBAI was subjected to a crude dismissal of its general manager, following which there was a sort of this crude station coup, which resulted in the enormous chaos that took place at WBAI from 2000 through the present, 2001 through the present. In any event, what I'm trying to say is that these things made me less and less sympathetic with the people who I had aligned myself with, and more sympathetic with the people who were protesting them, until I became them, in a sense. I became radicalized. I became less and less interested in a top-down sort of Pacifica governance system, and much more interested in a much more democratic system of governance, which is where I am now. And it's a very interesting thing to be 360 degrees away from where you were 3 years ago, because if you're a historian, it means that suddenly you go back into the past that you looked at one way 3 years ago, and now you're looking at it another way. Now you're asking entirely different questions, and you're looking at this whole body of information that you have, and you're asking different questions about it, and you're looking at it and trying to take it apart in all these different ways. And so I'm sitting here trying to figure out, in a sense, why did this happen? Why did all of this stuff that's happened over the last 7 years, what I now call the seven-year war, happen? Some people would argue probably that it's even longer than 7 years. I suppose that I just like the number seven, and I'm flexible. Maybe we'll call it the nine-year war someday. But for now, I'm calling it the seven-year war. And what I'd like to do is to go back with you to the beginning and try to construct a teleology of the present. Now, teleology is a real academic $10 word. All it means is a study designed to explain why things ended up the way they did. And so I want to go all the way back to the beginning and talk with you about the beginning of the organization and go through it to the present with an attempt to explain the present. Is that all right with you, Roy? Can we do that for
yes,
a while?
Yes, I'm all ears.
You're all ears? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well,
although I've been assured that talking about this stuff will immediately result in everybody turning off the radio, but I'm listening.
Okay, well, to all three of you who are still listening, here we go. You know that the organization was founded by this guy named Lewis Hill, and he was a pacifist. He was a conscientious objector during the Second World War, which was a very controversial position, and still is a very controversial position. I wouldn't have been a conscientious objector during the Second World War, but Lewis Hill was. And he came out of the experience of being a CO during the Second World War, feeling very strongly that pacifists had really been marginalized by the Second World War experience, which they had, and that he had to do something, and he and his friends had to do something to make pacifism more legitimate and more a part of people's daily life, get it away from being from this outsider status that it had, and making it integral to the community. And so he came to Northern California from Washington, D.C., where he was a lobbyist for COs during the Second World War after he had spent some time as being a CO. And he started the Pacifica Foundation in 1946, and he began to start the Pacifica Foundation's first project, which was the creation of KPFA in Berkeley. Now, when Lewis Hill started building KPFA and the Pacifica Foundation, he knew certain things, and he didn't know other things. He knew who his staff would be. Lewis Hill knew that his staff would be former conscientious objectors, which is mostly what they were. His original board of directors were all conscientious objectors. Most of the people who helped build KPFA were either conscientious objectors or they were close to conscientious objectors. Siblings, partners, wives, husbands, close friends, etc., etc. Lewis Hill knew who his big supporters were. He knew that they would be wealthy Quakers mostly, wealthy liberals, who he would put on some kind of titular advisory board, which became actually the first local advisory board. He knew who those people were, though, and he knew what he was going to do with them. There was one group of people he didn't know who they were, and he didn't know how he was going to include them in the organization, and that was his listeners. Because in 1946, 1947, and 1948, there weren't any listeners, right? All there was the Pacifica Foundation, which was about to create a radio station, but there were no listeners to it. In addition to that, Lewis Hill distrusted mass democracy. He didn't distrust little democracy, but he distrusted big democracy. And let me explain to you why. Imagine that KPFA, as a radio station, had not gone on the air in 1949. It had gone on the air as an FM radio station in 1939, which it could have done because FM was around and there were various people who were building FM stations. It was about 4 years old in 1939. So it's conceivable that if Lewis Hill had been a little younger, he was born in 1919, May 1st, 1919. If he'd been a little younger, and his friends had been a little younger, if this had all gone a little further back, they could have started it in 1939. Well, it would have started in 1939, and then the Second World War would have occurred, and Japan would have attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor, and the United States would have been involved in this war. And by 1942, they would have had this radio station, right, in which they were going on the air denouncing the war because they're pacifists. What do you think would have happened to them if they had had a listener-subscriber elected organization?
The subscribers would not be happy.
They would have voted them out. No question about it. Because as you know, as we all know right now, everybody loves pacifists until there's a war. Everybody deeply respects pacifists and thinks that pacifism is a wonderful thing until there's a war. Then they become denounced as fascists, as pacifists are being done, as pacifists were then, and they're being denounced as fascists today. Everybody loves pacifists until there's a war.
Or now, cowards.
Cowards, whatever. You know, you name all the bad names. Now, in fairness, the truth is that they wouldn't have just been voted out. They would have actually, people would have gone into the station and beaten them up and thrown them on the pavement. That's probably what would have happened. Anyway, very aware of the fact of how easily pacifists could be marginalized in war, Lewis Hill and his friends did not include the listener subscribers in the governance of the organization. Pacifica was essentially started as a kind of a worker cooperative. The staff made the decisions. And the staff was organized in this entity called the Executive Membership, and it elected the precursor to the Pacifica Board, which was called at the time the Committee of Directors. As time went on, 1949, 1950, 1951, Lewis Hill became increasingly distrustful of this system. He became increasingly distrustful of his staff. He and his close friends, Eleanor McKinney and Richard Moore, who were known within KPFA as the Triumvirate, and they were a very close group of people. They're all three very close to each other, began questioning whether the staff on its own could really make objective decisions, which sometimes involved the laying of people off, because there wasn't enough money. The station closed down for almost a year in 1950. It took an enormous effort to keep it going, and it really didn't survive on the basis of listener subscribers. It survived because it got a Ford Foundation grant, and that got it through the first half of the 1950s. And then increasingly, as FM became more popular in the later 1950s and early 1960s, KPFA and then KPFK and WPAI started coming into their own as radio stations. In 1953 and 1954, Pacifica had its first big fight. I mean, that fight was nothing compared to this fight, but it was big at the time. People experienced it as big at the time, largely because Hill wanted more power over hiring and firing. And a small group of people rebelled against Hill, led by a guy named Wallace Hamilton, who is largely forgotten in Pacifica history except in my and Jeff Land's books. They rebelled against Lewis Hill and literally kicked him out of the station. Among the supporters of this rebellion was your friend Alan Watts, who resented Lewis Hill's attempts to control personnel and to direct personnel. It is a myth that Pacifica never made any efforts. It's a myth that Pacifica, until recently, never made any efforts at editorial control of what was going on. Lewis Hill made all kinds of editorial controls during the 1950s, including the Committee of Directors saying that when it was fine for members of the Communist Party to speak on KPFA, but they had to identify themselves as such. Hill went through this titanic battle, comparatively speaking, with these people, basically fought his way back into the station, and began putting more and more power into what eventually became the local advisory board. He began putting more and more power into the hands of outside dignitaries, because he felt that there needed to be some kind of counterbalance to the staff. Because he didn't always feel that the staff could be objective about decisions about itself. When, as some of you know, some all three of you who are listening to this right now know, Lewis Hill killed himself in 1957. And shortly after that, in 1959, KPFK, which had been in the planning for a while, went on the air. And in 1960, WBAI was given to the Pacifica Foundation by a wealthy philanthropist. The successor to Lewis Hill was a man named Harold Winkler, who had distinguished himself among civil libertarians and pacifists because he had refused to sign a loyalty oath at the University of California at Berkeley, where he had been teaching political science. And Winkler, when the organization became national, he argued, and I think with some merit, that the old executive membership system was not going to work. I mean, this whole business of a staff cooperative, when you have three staffs thousands of miles away from each other, was really not going to work. And he got the organization to drop the cooperative system for a more traditional board of directors. And the organization in the early 1960s was actually pretty undemocratic on a national board level. It was a small national board that actually appointed the members of local advisory boards. It was not a terribly democratic system. But the culture of the organization in the early 1960s began to change. The old pacifist generation began to move away. And people who had really come into their own, not so much on the basis of their experience in pacifist student clubs in the 1940s and the CO experience during the Second World War, these were people who had locked horns with McCarthyism or who had witnessed European totalitarianism. I'm speaking specifically, most notably, of Bill Mandel in Berkeley, who is no longer a programmer at KPFA in Berkeley, but who was for many, many years a programmer there who was a commentator on Soviet affairs, and Elsa Knight Thompson, who was KPFA's program director and who actually had a hand in the formation, in the early organizing of your station, KPFK, in Los Angeles. The courageous fare, which characterized Pacifica through this period, challenging the assumptions of the Cold War, challenging McCarthyism, KPFA publicly carried anti-UAC hearings, played path-breaking documentaries about homosexuality in the 1950s. Lewis Hill denounced the FBI on the radio in the early 1950s. This attracted, by the early 1960s, a whole new generation of young people, mostly students, many of whom had cut their teeth in the free speech movement in Berkeley and the Columbia Uprising. And the organization became increasingly populist in its tone. If you look at early KPFA, it's a very highbrow, you know, KPFA, early KPFK, early WBAI, they're basically very highbrow radio stations. To a large extent, they were classical music stations with left and pacifist commentary. But now, with this younger generation, you see the adoption of a much more populist stance, less suspicious of democracy than Lewis Hill had been, and the tendency to describe the stations as people's radio stations. These are radio stations that are for the people, the voice of the voiceless. All the rhetoric that I think that you and I are both very familiar with begins emerging in the 1960s. Now, I have a rule, a sort of a warning about talking about democracy, which is that if you're going to go around talking around democracy, you should remember that sooner or later someone will believe that you mean it. And by the late 1960s, as Pacifica began making a national reputation for itself, especially around its courageous stance against the Vietnam War, a whole host of new peoples began taking Pacifica at its word. Blacks, Latinos, gays, feminists, a whole host of new groups began thronging around Pacifica, saying, well, you know, we're the people too, and we're going to take you on your word, and we expect some inclusion. By the late 1960s, early 1970s, and into the mid-1970s, the world literally rushed into the Pacifica radio network, really literally, and the organization got two other radio stations, KPFT in Houston in 1970 and WPFW in Washington, D.C. in 1977. And the organization, as it changed, responded by reconceptualizing itself, giving itself a new name. Now Pacifica was community radio. This is a very vague and interesting word, which can be interpreted about 20 different ways, and is very problematic in a lot of ways. But basically, the argument was that Pacifica's radio stations served diverse communities defined by various programmers who declared themselves part of these communities. The stations became filled with people. KPFA's program council by the 1976-1977 had 80 people in it. I mean, this little internal governance body had like 90 people would show up in a meeting. The labs became filled, the local advisory boards, which each station had, became filled with people, and which had now been codified by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which had emerged in the late 1960s to provide funding for public broadcasting, and which many people argue actually modeled much of its recommendations and requirements for community radio station governance on the Pacifica model. With two strikes at KPFA and KPFK in the 1970s, power began gradually drifting towards the local advisory boards, which became stronger and stronger, and which in 1978 or 1979 began appointing members to the national board. If you look at the minutes of the national board meetings, that's the first time you start seeing the labs start bringing people to the national board, reversing the trend which had started in the 1960s, where the labs themselves, where the national board actually would appoint people to the labs. So you have a somewhat more democratic structure emerging in the 1970s. You have an organization in which these radio stations are now literally packed with people, all kinds of different people, with all kinds of different agendas, trying to get along with varying degrees of success and to present something of a coherent program picture to the public. And then you have this external problem that is beginning to happen in the late 1970s, which is that at the same time that all these people are rushing in to the Pacifica radio network and elsewhere to all these other community state radio stations that are emerging across the United States, at the same time that this new community radio situation is sort of settling in the late 1970s, the space elsewhere for non-commercial community-based radio starts closing up. So you have this sort of democratic revolution in media across the United States, and especially at the Pacifica stations. And suddenly, the space elsewhere for it to expand and to grow starts to close up. The first thing that happens is the banning by the FCC of micro radio. Up until 1978 or 1979, I forgot which year it was, you could have 10-watt radio stations across the United States, and you had a lot of 10-watt radio stations. And suddenly, a lot of people starting to complain, national public radio starting to complain, even other community radio stations are starting to complain. And so the FCC banned all radio stations that were less than 100 watts from the picture. The FCC, with the advent of the Reagan administration, completely, the Federal Communications Commission, completely rethinks its attitude towards public service requirements. It starts relaxing its requirements that commercial radio stations have public service requirements, that some percentage of their airtime be devoted to public service-oriented shows. So this kind of community-based local radio starts to end. The FCC also starts expanding the amount of time that companies can hold licenses from about 3 to about 8 years. And this makes it easier for these companies, these radio stations, to sort of flout any kind of public service requirements. In 1987, the FCC abandoned the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine basically said that if you say something on your radio station that is a direct criticism of somebody or something, that the citizenry have the right to come on your radio station, since the people own the airwaves, and talk back and respond. The Fairness Doctrine was, to some extent, a venue for local access broadcasting. I don't really think that Rush Limbaugh could do the kind of radio that he does without the ending of the Fairness Doctrine. I mean, if the Fairness Doctrine still existed, every time Rush Limbaugh had a show, there would probably be a line around every radio station in the United States that ran him of citizens demanding their Fairness Doctrine right to be on the station to respond. The Fairness Doctrine really opened up, I think, opened up a hole for the kind of talk radio that we're seeing today. Then you also have the centralization of national public radio. You have public radio stations devoting more and more of their time to satellite and less of their time to volunteer shows. National Public Radio started in 1970. It was really supposed to be this sort of creative mix of all of these different reporters bringing together all of these different perspectives into this one professional program. But it increasingly became the raison d'etre of many, many public radio stations, and they began pushing out a lot of local programming. Then there was the emergence of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Healthy Station Project, which was run by Lynn Chadwick, who was former executive director of the Pacifica Foundation during this terrible time that KPFA faced in 1999. The Healthy Station Project would go around to these various community radio stations, and they would try to get them to run more satellite program and get rid of a lot of their volunteers. The Telecommunications Act in the mid-1990s relaxed the number of radio stations that a corporation could own. What it did was it said that any corporation can own an unlimited number of radio stations across the United States, but it was limited to 7 radio stations in any region. What this did was it immediately, the price of a radio station went through the roof. Thousands of radio stations changed hands in 1996 as a result of the passing of the Telecommunications Act. And the result was is that any corporation or company that bought a new radio station now had an enormous amount of debt which it had to deal with. And the result of that was is that these radio stations were more and more reluctant to have any kind of local community-based programming on their radio station. The CPB began requiring in around 1997 that stations measure their performance, that community radio stations measure their performance via Arbitron ratings and financial support, not via volunteer support. In other words, you had to now start, if you wanted Corporation for Public Broadcasting money, which Pacifica was now getting to the tune of, in the 1990s, I think an average of about $1 million a year, you had to measure your performance via Arbitron ratings and financial support, which meant that you really had to look at the Arbitron performance of lots of programs, which made volunteer shows increasingly vulnerable to being being kicked out. Now, I should tell you that it is very interesting to me, and it should be mentioned, I think, that one of the people who publicly denounced this in the New York Times, do you want to guess, Roy, who it was?
I don't have a clue. But
Mark Shubb.
Shubb. I'm speechless.
Mark Shubb denounced this in the New York Times. He most certainly did. And it should be noted that he denounced this in the New York Times despite the fact that Pat Scott, the executive director of Pacifica, sat on the committee that made this CPB rule. So let us give some credit where credit is due. What I saw as a result of this containment, what essentially happened in the 1980s and 1990s to this radio network, the Pacifica Radio Network, stuffed with all these people, was that it became contained. It became this network full of people fighting over increasingly scarce resources with nowhere else to go. And what I saw as a volunteer at KPFA in the 1980s was an increasing demoralization across the organization and the beginning of a of a discourse critical of community radio. And I think that we all know the basic components of that discourse. The schedules of the stations were too fragmented. Fragmentation and balkanization became these kind of watchwords. Too many programs with no connection to each other, parallel to each other or right next to each other. People who would stay forever. This became another big issue. We've got too many people here who have stayed forever. They have long worn out their welcome, and they don't have anything fresh to say. No quality control standards. Who's really deciding in this very fragmented schedule in which there are all of these people with all of these sort of identity politics kinds of ideology saying, you can't touch me and you don't have the right to make any decisions about what I'm doing. Where was the quality control?
And the story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, of some KPFA programmer who willed their...
This is a wonderful legend. This is a wonderful legend. Actually, I think that it starts at KPFK, and nobody willed anything. You had a programmer there who did a science fiction show for a while, and he died. And he basically asked a famous science fiction writer, I've forgotten his name now, to continue the program, and he did. And I think he made some kind of a comment on the air saying that, you know, the program had sort of been willed to him. But it's not true.
Sounds like Mike Hodel and Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, that's it. That's who it was. It's not true. Nobody ever left anything to anybody in their will.
Mike Hodel put me on the air, as a matter of fact.
But like all urban legends, and this is definitely a Pacifica urban legend, it makes a point. It's a metaphor that makes a point, which is the frustration that I think managers were having with the fact that there was really no room to maneuver anywhere, or at least that's the way people experienced it. What people did not, people in this discourse which emerged, and these criticisms of community radio, what was never around was any kind of awareness of how the external environment that I've just described impacted on community radio. People weren't experiencing what was going on outside as part of the problem. Gramsci, famous Marxist, Italian Marxist, once said that the most important thing that a dominant class tries to do to its subject class is to get them to experience the status quo as normal. And by the 1980s and 1990s, we were increasingly experiencing the rest of the world as normal and not really questioning the rest of the broadcasting world and not really thinking about its impact on us. By 1987, Pacifica really sort of sat at a crossroads because this containment was having a serious impact on the organization. By the mid-1990s, it was really having a very serious impact on the organization. And Pacifica really sat at a crossroads, and I could make a very crude analogy, which is that, like the Soviet Union in the 1920s, the Pacifica Network sort of had to make a choice. It could take advantage of the fact that it had this very valuable airtime, more valuable than ever before now because of the containment of non-commercial radio. I mean, the Pacifica stations were now caretakers of something that had been wiped out of large portions of the broadcasting sphere and the public sphere. And it could take advantage of this and just try to rationalize itself and build listener-supported radio in one small network. That's one direction it could go in. Socialism in one radio network, to make the crude analogy as crude as I possibly could. Or it could fight this containment. It could say, look, we've been boxed in. We need to unify around this issue, and we need to fight this containment, and essentially opt for a kind of a permanent revolution approach, declare that it's impossible to function in this constricted environment, and lead some kind of unified political attack on the corporatization of the airwaves. Well, we know that Pacifica chose the first route. And the document that really indicates that it chose the first route was the 1997 Strategic Plan, which is a publication which was put out by Pacifica and which Pacifica National Board members would endlessly refer people to over the next 5 years. I mean, it was a five-year plan in the sense that it planned out all these things that were going to happen over the next 5 years. But none of those things really happened. The five-year nature of it was that for the next 5 years, people would say, "What the hell are you doing?" And National Board members would say, go read the strategic plan. But the strategic plan was very clear about the fact that public democratic media, as it called it in the strategic plan, had disappeared from a large portion of the airwaves, and that Pacifica had this increasingly precious resource, and that it had to take advantage of it. But there were all of these people in the way, the strategic plan, this document essentially said, and it denounced what it called anarchic bureaucratic systems of governance. And these anarchic bureaucratic systems of governance were the station communities, essentially, and the systems of governance that they had created for themselves, and the local advisory boards. And so began the purges of volunteers that took place in the mid-1990s and through the late 1990s that we've all seen, and the weakening of local advisory boards, which began in the late 1990s and was essentially finished off with the throwing out of local advisory boards from the national board in February of 1999 at their February 28th national board meeting. Pacifica's central miscalculation over the last 5 years can be summarized in two things. They miscalculated about two things. I miscalculated about two things. Lots of people miscalculated about two things. It's easy to see these things in hindsight. The first was that getting back to Lewis Hill's decision not to include the listener subscribers in the governance, the new national board that now was a self-appointing national board in February of 1999 had no means of establishing their legitimacy to the rest of the organization, or to large portions of the rest of the organization. What I mean by legitimacy is the sense leaders are legitimate when you experience doing what they say as meaningful. Oh, it makes sense. These people will say, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we've decided we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And because of some social process that has taken place, you experience that as meaningful. In an organization which endlessly goes on and on and on about democracy everywhere in the world, having a central self-appointing national board was not meaningful to a large portion of the Pacifica population, especially that portion of the Pacifica population that had been booted out or downsized in terms of the amount of power that it had at Pacifica Radio. And the other problem, the other miscalculation which Pacifica made, was that there was nowhere else for all the people they displaced to go. This is equally important. There was just nowhere else to go. These people did not have another community radio station that they could go to. Some of them managed to go to micro radio, but not many. We've got a couple of micro radio stations here, which I can sometimes listen to in my car, but they're very small. For the most part, there was nowhere else to go, and so they stayed. And they used the Internet, and the Internet is a very important part of this story. They used the Internet as a means of unification, and they fought back. And the lack of any legitimacy and the fact that there was nowhere else to go are the reasons why, essentially, the Pacifica plan of 1997-1998 collapsed, and we are where we are today, which is with a national board whose majority actually speaks in the name of the rebellion that has just taken place. That's my teleology of what has happened. I think that, for me, the most important thing that can happen now. I know that there's all kinds of tumult and trouble at the various stations, yours especially, KPFT quite a bit. WBAI seems to be rather nicely reorganizing itself at the moment. KPFA sort of went through its hurricane some years ago, and I think as things are pretty stable here. For me, the most important thing that can happen at this point is that the local advisory boards of all of the stations need to become listener-subscriber-elected local advisory boards. Either all listener-subscriber-elected or partially listener-subscriber-elected, but certainly somewhat certainly the listener-subscribers need to have some kind of formal say in the organization. And the reason is not because I have this like inherent belief in democracy or anything like that. I mean, there are all kinds of problems. And Lewis Hill was right about some of the problems with the listener-subscribers on being able to vote. I mean, there are some real serious problems. But the main problem is that we are years and years away from Lewis Hill's situation and his vision of Pacifica Radio. And in our time, with this organization much, much bigger, we need to create a system which establishes a legitimate leadership, a leadership that is seen by as legitimate by a large portion of the organization. And I think that that means that we have to have listener, subscriber, local advisory boards which appoint members to the national board. I think it's really urgent that that happen. I don't think that for you three of you who are listening out there, you should not wait for anyone to tell you that this is something you should do. You should just go and do it. You will be doing the organization, in my opinion, an enormous favor by doing this. You will help KPFK, I think, enormously in protecting its independence, if that is important to you. And you will be moving in the direction of creating a more meaningful and legitimate leadership of the organization, because the organization needs a legitimate leadership. And the reason for that is because the conditions that I described, Roy, all those conditions, that this containment of the Pacifica Radio Network that I described, those conditions still exist. That problem, which is, in my opinion, the most pressing problem that Pacifica faces, that problem still exists. And so I really hope that we have learned a lesson here. And that is that we have to have a system of governance that resembles the political values that we articulate at Pacifica Radio. I certainly feel like I've learned a lesson. I certainly feel like the last 3 years have changed me, and I hope that that's the direction in which we're going.
Okay, so you're hopeful now.
Well, you may as well be.
This is KPFK Los Angeles, by the way. We are on the air live with Matthew Lazar as of Friday morning, the 25th of January, 2002. Matthew Lazar, one of the unofficial Pacifica historians and author of Pacifica, The Rise of an Alternative Network, which is amazingly detailed history of Pacifica from the earliest years. Okay, well, could we keep you awake a little longer to answer
Sure.
some phone calls? I have a question too, because you haven't dealt with my theory.
What's your theory?
Well, if you look at www.radio4all.net/fp/cpbfiring.htm, you see this document by Jeff Blankford called CPB Fires, Acting Inspector General, Action on Pacifica Halted Again. And it tells a story. There were three, originally when Pacifica first illegally closed its meetings to the public and started having secret, quote, retreats, and making all these infernal plans in secret, there were complaints because it was illegal to do that.
Yes.
And,
Jeff Blankford, who is a resident of the Bay Area, I'm not exactly sure where he lives. Jeff, intrepidly began filing complaints with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in behalf of an organization which he helped found called Take Back KPFA. And he began establishing a paper trail. He called one CPB's, he got one CPB's inspector to start inspecting the problem of closed meetings and other violations of CPB openness rules, and that guy got fired. And then another guy, I forget the whole story. One guy got a heart attack or something like that. And finally, he actually got somebody to inspect the Pacifica Foundation, and they issued a report that said, yeah, there were some bunch of malfeasances, and Pacifica needs to do something about that. And Jeff actually went to the CPB in Washington, D.C., and he presented his case on the basis of this. And on the other side, Jack O'Dell, who was the former president of the Pacifica Foundation, presented the Pacifica Foundation side. And the top leadership of the CPB exonerated Pacifica for reasons which I'm not entirely clear about. There is no question about the fact that the CPB plays, and it plays a very, very important role in allowing the Pacifica Foundation to move in the direction which it moved into. But before we get into a completely conspiratorial way of looking at this, although I don't think that that's a very fair word, before we get into a completely institutional way of looking at this, I think it's important to recognize that there were a lot of people in the organization who were disillusioned with the organization and who were therefore willing to support the Pacifica's top leadership, even though they were doing these things that were a violation of CPB rules. It wasn't just a one-sided thing. There was a receptiveness within the organization to an increased centralization, an increasing centralization of leadership and of programming, to getting rid of volunteers, to making sweeping changes at the various stations. This did not just happen as a result of the government coming down and doing it. There was a cooperation. There were people within the organization who were willing to cooperate with it, including myself up to a point. So we really have to have a kind of an organic analysis of this. And we have to recognize that it's not just a top-down government operation. There were, within the organization, people who were obviously willing to cooperate with the government and with this new way of dealing with community radio. It isn't just you just can't understand it in a monodimensional way. Now, having said that, I have to say that I think that Jeff Blankford did a service in terms of the things that he did. At the time, I made fun of him. I have to admit that. At the time, I made fun of him, but I was wrong and he was right. So there.
Well, I'll have to say back 10 years ago, when our then subscription director Sue Cohen was running around saying, "Pacifica is centralizing. Pacifica National is centralizing its power," and my reaction, along with everybody else's, was, "So what? You know, the national board doesn't do anything. The local board, who cares what they do?" And she seemed to think it was important, and it was a real Cassandra story because nobody cared and nobody listened to her, and she was right.
Well, I think it's important to it's important for me to say this, and that is that it isn't so bad. Centralization of some things might not be bad. The question is, who's giving consent for that? And under what circumstances are they giving consent for that?
And who's running it?
And who's running it? And under what system are they running it? So the question—it's not so much a question of centralization as much as it is a question of whether there is a legitimacy to the people who have this plan. Now, it may be that Pacifica just had to go through this in order to build a more democratic structure that ultimately, hopefully, leads to a more legitimate leadership. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But this is where we are now.